The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Ali Smith's sixth novel has just been published. It's called How to Be Both, and it's a double story of a young girl whose mother has just died and of the Renaissance artist with whom she becomes obsessed. Ali, this is your third novel to be longlisted for the Booker Prize.
I'm just going to say it's totally lovely fluke. It's just unbelievable. I couldn't have been luckier.
It was actually longlisted before it was published, which must be quite unusual. But I must also congratulate you for your recent venture into curating, which comprised a series of events at the Edinburgh Book Festival under the title Something Else, which seems entirely characteristic of you. Mm. It involved writers, in your words, at the top of their game and at the frontiers of form. They included the novelist Nicola Barker, the short story writer Lydia Davis, poet Jackie Kay, and our second guest on this podcast, Gillian Beer, author of books on Darwin and Lewis Carroll, among many others. Hello, Gillian.
Hello.
Now, first, since it's hot off the press, would you read us just a little bit of How to Be Both? Because what really struck me at the event was how much Lewis Carrollism there is in it.
That's lovely. It is last May in Italy. George and her mother and Henry are sitting after supper at a table outside a restaurant under some arches near the castle. Her mother has been going on and on to them, well, to George, because Henry is on a computer game about fresco structure, about how when some frescoes in a different Italian city were damaged in the 1960s in bad flooding, and the authorities and restorers removed them to mend them as best they could, they found underneath them the underdrawing their artists had made for them, and sometimes the underdrawings were significantly different from their surfaces, which is something they'd never have discovered if there hadn't been the damage in the first place. George is only half listening because the game Henry is looking at on the iPad is called Injustice, and George thinks Henry is far too young for it. "What game is it?" her mother says. "It's the one where all the cartoon superheroes have turned evil," George says. "It's really violent, Henry," her mother says. She takes an earphone out of one of Henry's ears. "What?" Henry says. "Find something less violent to do on there," his mother says. "Okay," Henry says, "if I must." "You must," his mother says. Henry puts the earphone back in and clicks off the game. He clicks on a download of Horrible Histories instead. Pretty soon he is giggling to himself. Not long after that, he falls asleep at the table with his head on the iPad. "But which came first?" her mother says. "The chicken or the egg? The picture underneath or the picture on the surface?" "The picture below came first," George says, "because it was done first." "But the first thing we see," her mother said, "and most times the only thing we see, is the one on the surface. So does that mean it comes first, after all? And does that mean the other picture, if we don't know about it, may as well not exist?" George sighs heavily. Her mother points across the way to the castle wall. A bus goes past. Its whole back is an advert for something in which there's a Madonna and child picture, as if from the past, except the mother is showing the baby Jesus how to look something up on an iPad. "We are sitting here having our supper," her mother's saying, "and looking at everything that's around us and over there, right there in front of us. Now, if this was a night 70 years ago..." "Yeah, but it isn't," George says. "It's now. We'd be sitting here watching people being lined up and shot against that wall, along from where those seats for the cafe bar are." "Ah, God," George says. "Mum, how do you even know that?" "Would it be better, or worse, or truer, or falser, if I didn't?" her mother says. George scowls. "History is horrible. It is a mound of bodies pressing down into the ground below cities and towns and the unending wars and the famines and the diseases and all the people starved or done away with or rounded up and shot or tortured and left to die or put up against the walls near castles or stood in front of ditches and shot into them. George is appalled by history, its only redeeming feature being that it tends to be well and truly over." "And which comes first?" her unbearable mother is saying. "What we see or how we see?" "Yeah, but that thing happening with the shooting, it was eons ago," George says. "Only 20 years before me, and here I am sitting here right now," her mother says. "Ancient history," George says. "And that's me," her mother says. "And yet, here I am, still happening."
Is that not Lewis Carroll, Gillian?
That sense of things which seem to have gone away, which are still there, and which you can't just dispense with. Yes, you must.
You mustn't dispense with it.
Yes.
I said that it was the story of a girl and a Renaissance artist, but as you might gather from that, they don't relate to each other in a sort of purely historical sense, in any simple term. And very tied up with the way the story is told is what a fresco is. This artist is quite an obscure painter, but he painted frescoes, and his frescoes were lost for a very long time and rediscovered. Yes. Tell us what it is about fresco that fascinated you.
Well, when I started even thinking about a new novel, the thing that had excited me was fresco structure, because of the surface and the depth, because there is the thing which you see that is so fresh, that was done all the hundreds of years ago and is yet still, because it's in this form, because it's been made into a new skin which is actually part of the wall. Literally as much skin as our skin is part of us, there on the wall, there it is. But if you take this off, and they've got the most fantastic ways of restoring frescoes now, you can find the underdrawings underneath, and they're called sinopiae, and the sinopiae are often different. Sometimes they're the same, sometimes they're exactly the same design. There's something which will go between the top and the bottom very exactly, you know, mathematically. Sometimes there are people in there who just aren't in the other one, or there, you know, there, something's been moved, or there's not a cross at all. It's instead a hill with something else on it. So it was the notion that there was an understory, that every time we look at the surface, there is something behind it. And then, of course, which one comes first? Is it the one in the past, the very, very first one, or is it the one which came after, the one which we can see, or we think we can see, and how do we... You know, it was a structural thing about fresco, about the fresco form, you know, that excited me.
Gillian, you during the talk, you both talked about the fact that it's the pocket watch that makes Alice follow the rabbit down the rabbit hole. So this fascination with time as a magic thing is something that both of you are interested in.
And time, just at that point, I think, when he was writing, had become a very fraught topic. You know, time and space, non-Euclidean geometries were all around, things were changing in that way. So when you get to the Hatter's tea party, there's that sense of the thing never ending, that they go round and round the table, for instance, and this impossibility of ever stopping this tea party, even though it's 5 o'clock, and it's always 5 o'clock in this place. A number of those were quite topical references as well to what people were arguing about, John Stuart Mill, indeed, in his book about logic. So there's both this sense of atemporality, and there are these hidden jokes also, if you like, as with a fresco, under the surface. There is another sketch, another joke very often, which is being shared with the immediate, those people who are reading it then. We aren't necessarily sharing those same jokes, but we're getting different jokes now out of it.
And that struck me that is so relevant to what you're doing in this book, isn't it? You could have had this conversation and then you sat down to write the book, but you didn't.
I think this may be the novel that Gillian, who wrote a novel when she was 14, actually wrote when she was 14. That's what I think. The thing about time is exactly, it's a really human thing. Human means to be layered and stratified, to hold all our pasts and all our futures and all our presents all at once in ourselves, and all the pasts, presents and futures of all the other people, if we would be honest, we would admit it, that we are connected in that way, exactly stratified, geologically stratified almost, you know. We are dimensional by time. So the notion of putting two stories together, one 500 years ahead of the other, and then allowing them to swivel as well, so that one could come first and one could come second, or it could be the other way around. It's a kind of meeting place where the past and the present meet, and the thing which happens is the real now, the real dimensional now, the real thing that time does, which is both at once. The layering of voices in here is kind of part of what we're talking about, which is that we're talking on this, but there are these voices behind us. It's exactly what it's like to live all the time with all these layers around us.
Yeah. And in particular, we've got children's voices going on in the background. Yeah. And I wanted to talk to you about children as well. Gillian, you read this brilliant Lewis Carroll poem, which I didn't know, called Red Riding Hood, and I wondered whether you'd read it for us now.
Yes. Into the wood, the dark, dark wood, forth went the happy child, and in its stillest solitude talked to herself and smiled, and closer drew the scarlet hood about her ringlets wild. And now at last she threads the maze, and now she need not fear. Frowning, she meets a sudden blaze of moonlight falling clear. Nor trembles she, nor turns, nor stays, although the wolf be near.
The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Well, there's a wolf near the children in your novels, Ali, isn't there? There's always a wolf near them, but you have a lot of children in your novels. You had Astrid, who's 12 in the accidental. You had Brooke, the 9-year-old Brooke in There But For There. Mm. And now you have George or Georgia.
Yeah. The thing about the child in the adolescent state are that they are wide open. They're wide open to the world in a way which is not yet fixed. And I am fascinated by exactly that, the point at which the fixedness is on its way and you can kind of see it coming. I mean, there's a sense in which children are more morally clear than we are because we've been fixed and we'd imagine it would be the other way around, but actually, because they have an openness, they have a direct conduit to those questions which seem, you know, much, much harder, much greyer later on. But I am always drawn to the thing which is imaginatively shifting, or I think. I also like the notion that there might be a Virginia wolf in there as well, just a, you know, the Red Riding Hood wolf, because it's I mean, think about a writer who could do anything with time, and who also at the same time knew she was stuck with chronology, because we all are stuck with chronology, and that's what the child and the adolescent state are. There are states where you, before you are stuck, and to some extent you know that the heralding sticking point is coming.
And you are moving into being stuck. I mean, this learning to read, learning to write, which is always local, you get into a particular language, into a particular script. But there is that marvellous moment when you're learning to read, something that most people forget, actually. It's very difficult for adults to remember learning to read. There's that moment when you have all these potential forms when you look at the blobs on the page, and the adults may not approve of what you see there, but you can see all sorts of other possibilities and other rhymes, other jingles, other suggestions.
One of the things that you were talking about, Gillian, about nonsense poem, without suggesting that this novel is nonsense, is it's full of puns, riddles, and the quiver of ambiguity, you said, which again just seems to sum up what Ali's project is.
And also, do you know what? The quiver of ambiguity is on the back of the arrow of directness. I mean, wherever that arrow is going, there's a quiver on the back which is just going, yes, you know, there's both at once all the time. It's about, you know, how you hit the target, really.
So do you have a sense of nonsense in it when you're writing, that you're sort of gathering up lots and lots of things? There is a sort of efflorescence of stuff in your novels often, of language, isn't there?
I think there's just an efflorescence of stuff in the world, and I think as long as we allow language to do what it does, which is to mean as many things as it does. I mean, like Gillian today was talking about Humpty Dumpty, the egg, saying, when I use a word, it means exactly what I say, it means exactly what I want it to mean, it doesn't mean anything else. You know, that's something that's going to break. You know, as soon as he falls off the wall, he's not going to stay together very long. Language in itself is a kind of fluidity. It's a historical fluidity. It's a present moment fluidity of all its meanings at once. And also the things we're not saying when we use language are all in there behind the things we say.
Yes, those voices that aren't speaking. I always think that's one of the pleasures of very close reading of a text. You can hear much more distinctly those unvoiced sayings that are there in the pauses and between the sentences.
Now, I don't think it would be too much of a spoiler to say that your book falls into two sections. Mm. As often, your novels all have a habit of falling into many sections.
Yes.
Two is relatively conservative.
Oh, no. I'll have to do something about that immediately.
But the second voice is the voice of the artist, and it's that whereas the first section is quite naturalistic, the second is not at all naturalistic. But what struck me is what a different form of historical writing you're doing, because it's not about historical vocabulary, it's about syntax.
Of this artist, Francesco del Cossa, who is an artist of whom we only have about 16 or 18 attributed works, and they are so beautiful. We only know this artist exists because he wrote a letter asking for more money for a set of paintings he did in Ferrara for one of the Duke Borso. They did these beautiful frescoes in this Palazzo Schifanoia in Ferrara. The Palazzo, of course, got handed on and went to ruin, and then, you know, 400 years later, those walls were covered in whitewash in a tobacco factory. That's what the Palazzo Schifanoia, the Palace of Joy or the Palace of Banishing Boredom, had become. The whitewash fell off the walls and these pictures appeared, and everybody was like, oh, new frescoes by Cosimo Tura. Oh, we've got a whole new set of works which were designed by Tura and were painted by the artists of the School of Ferrara. How lovely. And then Adolfo Venturi, who's a Modena-based art historian, found a letter in an archive I am the artist Francesco Del Cossa, and I have done the three fields in the Piazza Scavenoia, which are on this particular wall, and I wonder if you would just, you know, take a notice of the fact that, you know, I'm really good and I've got a name, and I've got more of a name than the other people working here at the moment, and I'm using really good colours, and I study really hard, and my work's really good, and I'm using fresco, it's an advanced form, you know, and I just wonder if you might pay me more than 10 bolognini per square foot, and if you want to do it secretly so nobody else, you know, knows that we're doing it, you can give me a gift, or if you'd like to pay everybody else as well, that would be nice, but, you know, I wait on, you know, humbly and see what you'll say, and at the bottom of which the Duke had written, pay him the same as everybody else.
Yeah.
Now we knew who this artist was, because we had a written piece of text. And if you look at that written piece of text, which is what survives, that we know that Francesco Del Cossa survives, because there's almost nothing recording him. There's a notion of who his father is, there's a notion of who his mother was, very, very, very little we know about him. But I do know his syntax, and I know he used colons, and I know that he used a kind of idiosyncratic version of Italian. So that's all I needed, really, to allow something, which was an unheard voice.
And this actually takes us on to, you're a Woolfian scholar as well as as well as Darwin and Carroll.
Yes.
You do Woolf, and Woolf is also somebody who plays with syntax in her work.
Yes. I like these effulgent sentences that don't look as though they're ever quite going to know where to end, and yet they find a poise at the end of the sentence, and that's something that Woolf does wonderfully, I think. And these sort of billowing sentences, as well as occasionally the really sharp single sentence that she will do, but they tend to be much more intricate than that. And I find that waywardness in a sentence very exhilarating, and those are the people I tend to work with.
You've known each other for a very long time, and Ali, when you first met, you were not convinced by Virginia Woolf, were you? You were, describe yourself as a Joycean.
I'm glad to say that Gillian was also, when she first read Virginia Woolf, not too sure what to make of Virginia Woolf. No, I think I had come on the backs of other people's prejudices. We're talking about the mid-80s, and we're talking about me having come from a very northern university where Woolf was, you know, as I found out when I taught about 10 years later at another university, was thought to be, you know, rather effete, and, you know, rather, you know, not a novelist who was really doing the things that we now know she was doing. One of the reasons we know that Woolf was the great writer that she is because of Gillian and because of academics who have gone out of their way to show what Woolf can do with artifice and what she can do with a sentence and what she can do with everything in the world. And the women's studies courses, which taught Woolf and which went out of their way to mark a canon, which otherwise, you know, Woolf by the 50s, everybody was saying, you know, she didn't, you know, she was like a minor footnote in the English novel. Virginia Woolf. That's what can happen in history. Off we go behind the whatever the whitewash is, until finally someone knocks the whitewash off and says, look at this, isn't this beautiful?
So is that how it felt to you at the time at which you started to work on
it? Yes, I remember going to a conference which was supposedly in celebration of some aspect of Woolf, but all the people who were speaking there apart from me were men, and for instance they said about To the Lighthouse, what a pity that she never, you know, engages at all with the First World War. They hadn't actually noticed time passes. They hadn't noticed the death of Andrew. There was so much that simply passed them by because that was the given, that she didn't engage with any full history. It was all little personal reminiscence and so on. And I was so aghast at that moment, but also so enraged, that I thought, well, there's a whole lot of work I want to do, a whole lot of thinking and reading and joining in with Woolf, if you know what I mean, rather than looking at her all the time from a long distance, which was the tendency then. Yeah, so yeah. I think women's studies certainly did have a big effect in reevaluating her.
And one area of your study, Gillian, that we haven't really touched on is Darwin. And Ali came up with this lovely phrase, which is that you're working in a period when language and knowledge act like doors to each other. This is also something that seems to inform your novels as well. I could get a sense of you reflecting your own practice through your appreciation of each other.
Can you imagine what it's like for somebody who writes in the kind of askance way that I do write? is interested in the askance or in the margins or in the what seems to be, you know, off to the side. Can you imagine what it's like to talk to a mind like Gillian's, who understands that the askance is everything that we are, and that all we are is askance, and that every question we ask in the word askance is something to do with curiosity and to do with the way that life works and to do with the way that we stay alive, we stay young, and we stay in this kind of state of responsiveness to the world, and the world also responds back to us, and there's something in dialogue, something which doesn't even, yes, you know, which is just always being asked between, you know.
I think one of the things I've always loved about the way in which Darwin thinks and works is that he doesn't necessarily home in on the thing that he's going to work on. He works in this profuse way. He looks at everything, he enjoys everything. He doesn't necessarily even see the relationships between things. He just sees so much, and he gets so much pleasure from that. And then he has to work, because he's working with language. He wasn't much of a mathematician. And language, after all, is communal, it's historical, it has all our assumptions embedded in it. So how do you get new ideas to come through language and communicate them? Because ideas don't work until they're communicated. And so that was what I became very fascinated by, in the way in which his mind is all the time trying out ideas rather than committing himself to things. He will always say, it seems, or it may be that, which may sound ponderous, but in fact isn't. It's a way of, as you say, being askance.
You also said that you've made the point that theories in their earliest stage are at their most fictive, which I thought was fascinating, the idea of formulating a story which then you go on to prove.
Yes, I think that is the state of science. It's partly why I've always felt that there was this kinship between the way the imagination works when it's writing stories and when you're, as a scientist, practicing and seeking for an experiment which will be, as they say, unifactorial. You only shift one little bit, and then you look at what happens when you shift one little bit of something. But at that moment, before you've quite reached the precision that allows you to do that, there are so many potentialities swirling around, and some people have the capacity to keep them all in play. And I think, like Keats, Darwin had that. And intriguingly, of course, they both trained as medics for quite a long time, and both of them stopped being medics because they couldn't bear the pain. This was before we had any anaesthetic. That's off at a tangent, if you like, but I think it's to do with empathy, that each of them has this highly empathetic imagination.
And fiction is about empathy, and the fictive is always after the quiver of truth. The fictive is one of our best ways of getting at the truth. It's one of our means of understanding what is true.
Well, thank you very much, both of you, for a fascinating conversation. How to Be Both is published by Hamish Hamilton, and Gillian Darwin's Plots is published by Cambridge University Press, and the collected poems of Lewis Carroll by Penguin Classics. But you also have written about Gravel, and you have another book about Lewis Carroll coming shortly.
Yes, which is under contract with Chicago, and I've got to brush it up and finish it off this winter. So,
Well, we look forward to that. Thank you.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code Guardian to take 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.